over its menacing bulk. "Do you see Grandad, Jem?" he asked, keeping his voice calm. Streaks of fire were burning through his arms, and his elbows felt as though they'd been crushed in a vice.
"No,"
Jemmy whispered. Roger could feel the little boy crowding close behind him, pressed against his legs.
"Well, look round. He went to the stream. He'll be coming back from that direction. Turn round and look."
The boar was cautious, but not afraid. That's what came of not hunting the things sufficiently, he thought. They ought to be gutting a few in the wood once a week as an object lesson to the rest.
"Granda!"
Jemmy's voice rang out from behind him, shrill with fear. At the sound, the pig's hackles sprang suddenly erect in a ridge of coarse hair down its spine, and it lowered its head, muscles bunching.
"Run, Jem!" Roger cried. "Run to Granda!"
A surge of adrenaline shot through him, and suddenly the rock weighed nothing. He flung it at the charging pig, catching it on the shoulder. It gave a woof of surprise, faltered, then opened its mouth with a roar and came at him, tushes slashing as it swung its head. He couldn't duck aside and let it go past. Jem was still close behind him. He kicked it in the jaw with all his strength, then flung himself on it, grasping for a hold round its neck. His fingers slipped and slid, unable to get a firm grip on the wiry hair, stubbing and sliding off the hard rolls of tight-packed flesh. Christ, it was like wrestling an animated sack of concrete. He felt something warm and wet on his hand and jerked it back. Had it slashed him? He felt no pain. Maybe only saliva from the gnashing jaws. Maybe blood from a gash too deep to feel. No time to look. He thrust the hand back down, flailing blindly, got his fingers round a hairy leg and pulled. The pig fell sideways with a squeal of surprise, throwing him off its back. He hit the ground on hands and one knee, and his knee struck stone. A bolt of pain shot from ankle to groin, and he curled up involuntarily, momentarily paralysed from the shock. The boar was up, shaking itself with a grunt and a rattle of bristles, but facing away from him. Dust rose from its coat, and he could see the corkscrew tail coiled up tight against its rump. A second more and the pig would turn, rip him from gut to gullet and stamp on the pieces. He grabbed for a rock, but it burst in his hand, nothing but a clod of dirt. The gasp and thud of a running man came from his left, and he heard a breathless shout.
"Tullacharst! Tullacharst!"
The boar heard Jamie's cry and swung snorting round to meet this new enemy, mouth agape and eyes gone red with rage. Jamie had his dirk in his hand. Roger saw the gleam of metal as Jamie dropped low and swung it wide, slashing at the boar, then danced aside as it charged. A knife? Fight that thing with a knife?
"You are out of your fucking mind," Roger thought quite clearly.
"No, I'm not,"
Jamie said, panting, and Roger realised that he must have spoken aloud. Jamie crouched, balanced on the balls of his feet, and reached his free hand toward Roger, his eyes still fastened on the pig, which had paused, kneading the ground with its hooves and clashing its teeth, swinging its head back and forth between the two men, estimating its chances.
"Yoran,"
Jamie said, beckoning urgently.
"Stick, spear, gie it to me."
Spear. The splintered fence pole. His numbed leg still wouldn't work, but he could move. He threw himself to the side, grabbed the ragged shaft of wood and fell back on his haunches, bracing it before him like a boar spear, sharp end pointed toward the foe.
"Tullacharst," he bellowed. "Come here, you fat fucker."
Distracted for an instant, the boar swung toward him. Jamie lunged at it, stabbing down, aiming between the shoulder blades. There was a piercing squeal and the boar wheeled, blood flying from a deep gash in its shoulder. Jamie threw himself sideways, tripped on something, fell and skidded hard across the mud and grass, the knife spinning from his outflung hand. Lunging forward, Roger jabbed his makeshift spear as hard as he could just below the boar's tail. The animal uttered a piercing squeal and appeared to rise straight into the air. The spear jerked through his hands, rough bark ripping skin off his palms. He grabbed it hard and managed to keep hold of it as the boar crashed onto its side in a blur of writhing fury, gnashing, roaring, and spraying blood and black mud in all directions. Jamie was up, mud-streaked and bellowing. He'd got hold of another fence pole, with which he took a mighty swing at the rising pig, the wood meeting its head with a crack like a well-hit baseball, just as the animal achieved its feet. The boar, mildly stunned, gave a grunt and sat down. A shrill cry from behind made Roger whirl on his haunches. Jemmy, his grandfather's dirk held over his head with both hands and wobbling precariously, was staggering toward the boar, his face beet red with ferocious intent.
"Jem!" he shouted. "Get back!"
The boar grunted loudly behind him, and Jamie shouted something. Roger had no attention to spare. He lunged toward his son, but caught a flicker of movement from the wood beyond Jemmy that made him glance up. A streak of grey low to the ground and moving so fast that he had no more than an impression of its nature. That was enough.
"Wolves!" he shouted to Jamie.
And with a feeling that wolves on top of pigs was patently unfair, reached Jemmy, grabbed the knife, and threw himself on top of the boy. He pressed himself to the ground, feeling Jemmy squirm frantically under him, and waited, feeling strangely calm. Would it be tusk or tooth, he wondered.
"It's all right, Jem. Be still. It's all right. Daddy's got you."
His forehead was pressed against the earth, Jem's head tucked in the hollow of his shoulder. He had one arm sheltering the little boy, the knife gripped in his other hand. He hunched his shoulders, feeling the back of his neck bare and vulnerable, but couldn't move to protect it. He could hear the wolf now, howling and yipping to its companions. The boar was making an ungodly noise, a sort of long, continuous scream, and Jamie, too short of breath to go on shouting, seemed to be calling it names in brief, incoherent bursts of Gaelic. There was an odd whirr overhead, and a peculiar, hollow-sounding thump, succeeded by sudden and utter silence. Startled, Roger raised his head a few inches and saw the pig standing a few feet before him, its jaw hanging open in what looked like sheer astonishment. Jamie was standing behind it, smeared from forehead to knee with blood-streaked mud and wearing an identical expression. Then the boar's front legs gave way, and it fell to its knees. It wobbled, eyes glazing, and collapsed onto its side, the shaft of an arrow poking up, looking frail and inconsequential by comparison to the animal's bulk. Jemmy was squirming and crying underneath him. He sat up slowly and gathered the little boy up into his arms. He noticed, remotely, that his hands were shaking, but he felt curiously blank. The torn skin on his palms stung, and his knee was throbbing. Patting Jemmy's back in automatic comfort, he turned his head toward the wood and saw the Indian standing at the edge of the trees, bow in hand. It occurred to him, dimly, to look for the wolf. It was nosing at the pig's carcass, no more than a few feet from Jamie, but his father-in-law was paying it no mind at all. He, too, was staring at the Indian.
"Ian," he said softly,
and a look of incredulous joy blossomed slowly through the smears of mud, grass, and blood.
"Oh, Christ, it's Ian!"
Chapter 109. The Voice of Time. As Lizzie had no mother to see to her proper fitting out for marriage, the women on the ridge had grouped together to provide things like petticoats, nightgowns, and knitted stockings, with a few of the more talented ladies piecing quilt blocks. When a quilt top was completed, everyone would come up to the big house to see to the actual quilting, the laborious stitching together of quilt top and backing, with whatever might be available in the way of batting, worn-out blankets, stitched-together rags, or wool combings, laid in between quilt top and backing for warmth. I had neither great talent nor great patience for sewing generally, but I did have the manual dexterity for small, fine stitches. More importantly, I had a large kitchen with good light and enough room for a quilting frame, plus the services of Mrs. Bug, who kept the quilters well supplied with mugs of tea and endless plates of apple scones. We were in the midst of quilting a block pattern Mrs. Evan Lindsay had pieced out in creams and blues when Jamie appeared suddenly in the door to the hallway. Caught up in an absorbing conversation about the snoring of husbands in general, and theirs in particular, most of the women didn't notice him, but I was facing the door. He seemed not to want to interrupt or to attract attention, for he didn't come into the room. But once he'd caught my eye, he jerked his head urgently and disappeared toward his study. I glanced at Bree, who was sitting next to me. She'd seen him. She raised an eyebrow and shrugged. I popped the knot, jerking the knotted end of my thread up between the layers of fabric so it wouldn't show, stabbed my needle through the quilt top, and got up, murmuring an excuse.
"Give him beer to his supper," Mrs. Chisholm was advising Mrs. Aberfeldy. "A great deal of it, and well watered. That way he'll have to wait to piss every half hour, and can't get started with the sort of rumption that shakes the shingles loose."
"Why?" Mrs. Aberfeldy objected. "I tried that. But when he comes back to bed, he's wanting to..."
"Mm-hmm." She flashed red as the ladies all cackled.
"I get less sleep than I do with the snoring."
Jamie was waiting in the hall. The moment I appeared, he grabbed me by the arm and hustled me out of the front door.
"What?"
I began, bewildered. Then I saw the tall Indian sitting on the edge of the stoop.
"What?"
I said again. And then he stood up and turned and smiled at me.
"Ian!"
I shrieked, and flung myself into his arms. He was thin and hard as a piece of sun-dried rawhide, and his clothes smelled of wood damp and earth, with a faint echo of the smoke and body smells of a longhouse. I stood back, wiping my eyes, to look at him, and a cold nose nudged my hand, making me utter another small shriek.
"You!"
I said to Rollo. "I thought I'd never see you again." Overcome with emotion, I rubbed his ears madly. He uttered a short bark and dropped to his forepaws, wagging equally madly.
"Dock! Dock, dock! Here, dock!"
Jemmy burst from the door of his own cabin, running as fast as his short legs would carry him, wet hair standing on end and face beaming. Rollo shot toward him, hitting him amidships and bowling him over in a flurry of squeals. I had at first feared that Rollo, who was after all half-wolf, saw Jemmy as prey, but it was immediately apparent that the two were merely engaged in mutually ecstatic play. Brianna's maternal sonar had picked up the squealing, though, and she came rushing to the door.
"What?"
she began, eyes going to the melee taking place on the grass. Then Ian stepped forward, took her in his arms, and kissed her. Her shriek, in turn, brought the quilting circle boiling out onto the porch in an eruption of questions, exclamations, and small subsidiary shrieks in acknowledgement of the general excitement. In the midst of the resulting pandemonium, I suddenly noticed that Roger, who had appeared from somewhere, was sporting a fresh raw graze across his forehead, a black eye, and a clean shirt. I glanced at Jamie, who was standing next to me watching the goings-on, his face wreathed in a permanent grin. His shirt, by contrast, was not only filthy, but ripped down the front and with an enormous rent in one sleeve. There were huge smears of mud and dried blood on the linen too, though I didn't see any fresh blood showing. Given Jemmy's wet hair and clean shirt, not that it was any more, this was all highly suspicious.
"What on earth have you lot been doing?" I demanded.
He shook his head, still grinning.
"It doesn't signify, Sassenach, though I have got a fresh hog for you to butcher, when you've the time."
I pushed back a lock of hair in exasperation.
"Is this the local equivalent of killing the fatted calf in honour of the prodigal's return?"
I asked, nodding at Ian, who was by now completely submerged in a tide of women. Lizzie, I saw, was clinging to one of his arms, her pale face absolutely ablaze with excitement. I felt a slight qualm seeing it, but pushed it away for the moment.
"Has Ian brought friends? Or his family, perhaps?"
He had said his wife was expecting, and that was nearly 2 years back. The child, if all had gone well, must be nearly old enough to walk. Jamie's smile dimmed a little at that.
"No," he said. "He's alone. Save for the dog, of course," he added with a nod at Rollo, who was lying on his back, paws in the air, squirming happily under Jemmy's onslaught.
"Oh, well."
I smoothed down my hair and retied the ribbon, beginning to think what ought to be done regarding the quilters, the fresh hog, and some sort of celebratory supper, though I suppose Mrs. Bug would deal with that. How long is he staying, did he say? Jamie took a deep breath, putting a hand on my back.
For good, he said.
And his voice was full of joy, but with an odd tinge of sadness that made me look up at him in puzzlement.
He's come home.
It was very late indeed before the butchering, the quilting, and the supper were all finished, and the visitors finally left, charged with gossip. Though not so much gossip as all that. Ian had been friendly to everyone, but reticent, saying very little about his journey from the north, and nothing at all about the reasons behind it. "Did Ian tell you anything?" I asked Jamie, finding him temporarily alone in his study before dinner. He shook his head.
"Very little. Only that he'd come back to stay."
"Do you suppose something dreadful happened to his wife? And the baby?" I felt a deep pang of distress, both for Ian and for the slight, pretty Mohawk girl called Wakyo Tehi Honsna. Works with her hands. Ian had called her Emily. Death in childbirth was not uncommon, even among the Indians. Jamie shook his head again, looking sober.
I dinna ken, but I think it must be something of the kind. He hasna spoken of them at all, and the lad's eyes are a great deal older than he is.
Lizzie had appeared at the door then, with an urgent message from Mrs. Bug regarding dispositions for supper, and I had to go. Following Lizzie toward the kitchen, though, I couldn't help wondering just what Ian's return might mean to her, particularly if we were right in our suppositions about Ian's Mohawk wife. Lizzie had been half in love with Ian before he had left, and had pined for months following his decision to stay with the Ganawaga. But that was more than 2 years ago, and 2 years can be a very long time, especially in a young person's life. I knew what Jamie meant about Ian's eyes, and knew for certain that he wasn't the same impulsive, cheerful lad we had left with the Mohawk. Lizzie wasn't quite the timidly adoring girl-mouse she had been, either. What she was, though, was Manfred McGilvery's betrothed. I could only be thankful that neither Uta McGilvery nor any of her daughters had been present at this afternoon's quilting circle. With luck, the glamour of Ian's return would be short-lived. "Will you be all right down here?" I asked Ian dubiously. I had put several quilts and a goose-down pillow on the surgery table for him, he having politely rejected Mr. Weems's offer of his own bed, and Mrs. Bug's desire to make him a comfortable pallet before the kitchen hearth.
"Oh, aye, auntie," he said, and grinned at me. "You wouldn't credit the places Rollo and I've been sleeping."
He stretched, yawning and blinking.
"Christ! I've no been up past sunset any time this month or more."
"And up at dawn, too, I expect. That's why I thought you might be better in here. No one will disturb you if you'd like to sleep late in the morning." He laughed at that.
"Only if I leave the window open so Rollo can come and go as he likes. Though he seems to think the hunting might be good enough inside."
Rollo was seated in the middle of the floor, muzzle lifted in anticipation, his yellow wolf eyes fixed unwaveringly on the upper cupboard door. A low rumbling noise, like water bumping in a kettle, issued from behind the door.
"I'll gee odds on the cat, Ian," Jamie observed, coming into the surgery. "He's a very high opinion of himself, as we had so. I saw him chase a fox last week."
"The fact that you were behind him with a gun had nothing to do with the fox's running away, of course," I said.
"Well, not so far as young Cheaty's concerned," Jamie agreed, grinning.
"Cheaty," Ian repeated softly. "It feels very good to speak Scots again, Uncle Jamie."
Jamie's hand brushed Ian's arm lightly.
"I suppose it does, a vish o'hara,"
he said, just as softly.
"Well, you've forgotten all your Gaelic, then."
Ian replied without hesitation in Gaelic. It was a well-known saying. Little does the landsman know how the seaman lives. Jamie laughed in gratified surprise, and Ian grinned broadly back. His face was weathered to a deep brown, and the dotted lines of his Mohawk tattoos ran in fierce crescents from nose to cheekbones. But for a moment, I saw his hazel eyes dance with mischief, and saw again the lad we had known.
I used to say things over in my mind, he said, the grin fading a little. I'd look at things and say the words in my mind. Arava, Cora, Skirly, so as not to forget.
He glanced shyly at Jamie.
You did tell me to remember, Uncle.
Jamie blinked and cleared his throat.
So I did, Ian, he murmured. I'm glad of it.
He squeezed Ian's shoulder hard, and then they were embracing fiercely, thumping each other's backs with wordless emotion. By the time I'd wiped my own eyes and blown my nose, they had separated and resumed an air of elaborate casualness, affecting to ignore my descent into female sentiment.
I kept hold of the Scots and the Gaelic, Uncle, Ian said, clearing his own throat. The Latin was a bit beyond me, though. I kind of think you'd have had much occasion to practice your Latin, Jamie said.
He wiped his shirt sleeve under his nose, smiling.
Unless a wandering Jesuit happened by.
Ian looked a little queer at that. He glanced from Jamie to me, then at the door to the surgery, to be sure no one was coming.
Well, it wasn't exactly like that, Uncle, he said.
He walked quietly to the door, peeked out into the hallway, then closed the door softly and came back to the table. He had worn a small leather bag tied at his waist, which, aside from knife, bow and quiver, appeared to contain the whole of his worldly possessions. He had put this aside earlier, but now picked it up and rummaged briefly in it, withdrawing a small book bound in black leather. He handed this to Jamie, who took it, looking puzzled.
That is, just before I left Snake Town, the old lady, Tewaktunyona, gave me that wee book. I'd seen it before. Emily...
He stopped, clearing his throat hard, then went on steadily.
Emily begged a page of it for me to send you a note to say all was well. Did you get that?
Yes, we did, I assured him. Jamie sent it to your mother later.
Why?
Ian's expression lightened at thought of his mother.
That's good. She'll be pleased to hear I've come back, I hope. I'll lay you any odds you like on that one, Jamie assured him. But what's this?
He lifted the book, raising a brow in question.
It looks like a priest's breviary.
So it does,
Ian nodded, scratching at a mosquito bite on his neck.
That's not what it is, though. Look at it, eh?
I moved closer to Jamie, looking over his elbow as he opened the book. There was a ragged edge of paper where the flyleaf had been torn out. There was no title page, though, nor printing. The book appeared to be a journal of some sort. The pages were filled with writing in black ink. Two words stood alone at the top of the first page, scrawled in large, shaky letters.
Ego sum, they said.
I am.
Are you then?
Jamie said, half under his breath.
Aye, and who will you be?
Half down the page, the writing continued. Here the writing was smaller, more controlled, though something seemed odd-looking about it.
Prima cogitatio est. This is the first thing that comes into my head,
Jamie read softly, translating aloud.
I am. I still exist. Did I, in that place between? I must have, for I remember it. I will try later to describe it. Now I have no words. I feel very ill.
The letters were small and rounded, each printed singly, the work of a neat and careful writer, but they staggered drunkenly, words slanting up the page. He did feel ill, if the writing were any indication. When the tidy printing resumed on the next page, it had steadied, along with the writer's nerve.
Ibi denim locus. It is the place. Of course it would be. But it is the proper time as well. I knew it. The trees, the bushes are different. There was a clearing to the west, and now it is completely filled with laurels. I was looking at a big magnolia tree when I stepped into the circle, and now it is gone. There is an oak sapling there. The sound is different. There is no noise of highway and vehicles in the distance. Only birds singing very loudly. Wind. I'm still dizzy. My legs are weak. I cannot stand yet.
I woke under the wall where the snake eats its tail, but some distance from the cavity where we laid the circle. I must have crawled. There are dirt and scratches on my hands and clothes. I lay for some time after waking, too ill to rise. I am better now, still weak and sick, but I am exultant nonetheless. It worked. We have succeeded.
We, I said, looking at Jamie with both eyebrows raised. He shrugged and turned the page.
The stone is gone. Only a smear of soot in my pocket. Raymond was right then. It was a small unpolished sapphire. I must remember to put down everything for the sake of others who may come after me.
A small cold shudder of premonition flowed up my back and over me, making my scalp tingle as the hair on my head began to stand. Others who may come after me. Not meaning to, I reached out and touched the book, an irresistible impulse. I needed to touch him somehow, make some contact with the vanished writer of these words. Jamie glanced curiously at me. With some effort, I took my hand away, curling my fingers into a fist. He hesitated for a moment, but then looked back at the book as though the neat black writing compelled his gaze as it did my own. I knew now what had struck me about that writing. It had not been written with a quill. Quill writing, even the best, was uneven in colour, dark where the quill was freshly dipped, fading slowly through a line of writing. Every word of this was the same, written in a thin, hard line of black ink that slightly dented the fibres of the page. Quills never did that. Ballpoint, I said. He wrote it with a ballpoint pen. My God. Jamie glanced back at me. I must have looked pale, for he moved as though to close the book, but I shook my head, motioning him to go on reading. He frowned dubiously, but with one eye still on me, looked back. Then his attention shifted wholly to the book, and his brows rose as he looked at the writing on the next page. Look, he said softly, turning the book toward me and pointing to one line. Written in Latin like the others, but there were unfamiliar words mixed into the text. Long, strange-looking words.
Mohawk, Jamie said.
He looked up into Ian's face.
That's a word in an Indian tongue, surely. One of the Algonquian tongues, no?
Rain's hard, said Ian quietly. It is the Ganawaga, the Mohawk tongue, uncle. Rain's hard is someone's name, and the others written there too. Strong Walker, Six Turtles, and Talks for Spirits.
I thought the Mohawk have no written language, Jamie said, one ruddy eyebrow lifted.
Ian shook his head.
Nor they do, Uncle Jamie. But someone wrote that.
He nodded at the page.
And if you work out the sound of the words, he shrugged, they are Mohawk names, I'm sure of it.
Jamie looked at him for a long moment, then without comment, bent his head and resumed his translation.
I had one of the sapphires, Rain's Hard the other. Talks with Spirits had a ruby, Strong Walker took the diamond, and Six Turtles had the emerald. We were not sure of the diagram, whether it should be 4 points for the directions of the compass, or 5 in a pentacle. But there were the 5 of us, sworn by blood to this deed. So we laid the circle with 5 points.
There was a small gap between this sentence and the next, and the writing changed, becoming now firm and even, as though the writer had paused, then taken up his story at a later point.
I have gone back to Luke. There is no sign of the circle, but I see no reason why there should be, after all. I think I must have been unconscious for some time. We laid the circle just inside the mouth of the crevice, but there are no marks on the earth there to show how I crawled or rolled to the spot where I woke. And yet there are marks in the dust made by rain. My clothes are damp, but I cannot tell if this is from rain, from morning dew, or sweat from lying in the sun. It was near midday when I woke, for the sun was overhead, and it was hot. I'm thirsty. Did I crawl away from the crevice and then collapse?
or was I thrown some distance by the force of the transition? I had the most curious sense hearing this, that the words were echoing somewhere inside my head. It wasn't that I had heard it before, and yet the words had a dreadful familiarity. I shook my head to clear it, and looked up to find Ian's eyes on me, soft brown and full of speculation. "Yes," I said boldly, in answer to his look. "I am. Brianna and Roger, too." Jamie, who had paused to disentangle a phrase, looked up. He saw Ian's face and mine, and reached to put his hand on mine.
"How much could you read, lad?" he asked quietly.
"Quite a lot, Uncle," Ian answered, but his eyes didn't leave my face.
"Not everything."
A brief smile touched his lips.
"And I'm sure I haven't got the grammar right. But I think I understand it. Do you?"
It wasn't clear whether he addressed the question to me or Jamie. Both of us hesitated, exchanged a glance. Then I turned back to Ian and nodded, and so did Jamie. Jamie's hand tightened on mine.
"Mm-hmm," Ian said,
and his face lighted with an expression of profound satisfaction.
"I knew you weren't a fairy, Auntie Claire."
Unable to stay awake much longer, Ian had finally retired, yawning, though pausing in his flight toward bed, to seize Rollo by the scruff of the neck and immobilize him, while I removed Adso from the cupboard, fluffed to twice his normal size and hissing like a snake. Holding the cat by his own scruff to avoid being disemboweled, I had carried him out of harm's way up to our bedroom, where I dumped him unceremoniously on the bed, turning at once to Jamie. "What happened next?" I demanded. He was already lighting a fresh candle. Unfastening his shirt with one hand and thumbing the book open with the other, he sank down onto the bed, still absorbed in the reading.
"He couldn't have found any of his friends. He searched the countryside nearby for 2 days, calling, but there was no trace. He was very much distraught, but at last he thought he must go on. He was in need of food and had nothing but a knife and a bit of salt with him. He must hunt or find people."
Ian said that Tewak Tenyona had given him the book, enjoining him to bring it to me. It had belonged to a man named Ottertooth, she said, a member of my family. An icy finger had touched my spine at that and hadn't gone away. Little ripples of unease kept tickling over my skin like the touch of ghostly fingers. My family, indeed. I had told her that Ottertooth was perhaps one of my family, unable to describe the peculiar kinship of time travellers in any other way. I'd never met Ottertooth, at least not in the flesh. But if he was the man I thought he was, then his was the head buried in our small burying ground, complete with silver fillings. Perhaps I was at last going to learn who he had really been, and how on earth he'd come to meet such a startling end.
"He wasn't much of a hunter," Jamie said critically, frowning at the page. "Couldn't catch so much as a ground squirrel with a snare, and in the middle of summer forby."
Fortunately for Ottertooth, if it was indeed he had been familiar with a number of edible plants, and seemed extremely pleased with himself for recognising pawpaw and persimmon.
"Recognising a persimmon is no great feat, for God's sake," I said. "They look like orange baseballs." "And they taste like the bottom of a chamber pot," Jamie added, he not caring at all for persimmons. "Still, he was hungry by that time, and if you're hungry enough..."
He trailed off, lips moving silently as he continued his translation. The man had wandered through the wilderness for some time, though wandering seemed not quite right. He had chosen a specific direction, guided by the sun and stars. That seemed odd. What had he been looking for? Whatever it was, he had eventually found a village. He didn't speak the language of the inhabitants.
Why ought he to think he should? Jamie wondered aloud,
but had become extraordinarily distraught, according to his writing, at the discovery that the women were using iron kettles to cook with. "Tewak Tenyona said that," I interrupted, "when she was telling me about him. If it's the same man," I added. Pro forma. She said he carried on all the time about the cooking pots and the knives and guns. He said the Indians were, how did she put it? They needed to return to the ways of their ancestors, or the white man would eat them alive.
A very excitable fellow, Jamie muttered, still riveted to the book, and with a taste for rhetoric, too.
Within a page or two, though, the source of Ottertooth's strange preoccupation with cooking pots became somewhat clearer.
I have failed, Jamie read. I am too late.
He straightened his back and glanced at me, then went on.
I do not know exactly when I am, nor can I find out. These people will not reckon years by any scale I know, even had I enough of their tongue to ask. But I know I am too late. Had I arrived when I meant to, before 1650, there would be no iron in a village so far inland. To find it here in such casual use means that I am at least 50 years too late. Perhaps more.
Ottertooth was cast into great gloom by this discovery, and spent several days in utmost despair. But then he pulled himself together, determining that there was nothing to be done but to go on. And so he had set out alone, though with the gift of some food from the villagers, heading north.
I've no idea what the man thought he was doing, Jamie observed, but I will say he shows courage. His friends are dead or gone, and he's nothing with him, no notion where he is. And yet he goes on.
Yes, though in all honesty, I don't suppose he could think of anything else to do, I said. I touched the book again, gently, remembering the first few days after my own passage through the stones. The difference, of course, was that this man had chosen to come through the stones on purpose. Exactly why he had done it and how wasn't revealed just yet. Travelling alone through the wilderness, with nothing but this small book for company, Ottertooth had, he said, decided that he would occupy his mind with setting down an account of his journey, with its motives and intents.
Perhaps I will not succeed in my attempt, our attempt. In fact, it seems likely at the moment that I will simply perish here in the wilderness. But if that is so, then the thought that some record of our noble endeavour remains will be some consolation, and it is all the memorial I can provide for those who were my brothers, my companions in this adventure.
Jamie stopped and rubbed his eyes. The candle had burned far down. My own eyes were watering so much from yawning that I could scarcely see the page in the flickering light, and I felt light-headed from fatigue. "Let's stop," I said, and laid my head on Jamie's shoulder, taking comfort from its warm solidness. I can't stay awake any longer, I really can't, and it doesn't seem right to rush through his story.
Besides...
I stopped, interrupted by a jaw-cracking yawn that left me swaying and blinking. Perhaps Bree and Roger should hear this too. Jamie caught my yawn and gaped hugely, then shook his head violently, blinking like a large red owl shaken rudely out of its tree.
"Aye, you're right, Sassenach."
He closed the book and laid it gently on the table by the bed. I didn't bother with any sort of bedtime toilette, merely removing my outer clothes, brushing my teeth, and crawling into bed in my shift. Adso, who'd been snoozing happily on the pillow, was disgruntled at our appropriation of his space, but grumpily moved at Jamie's insistence, making his way to the foot of the bed, where he collapsed on my feet like a large furry rug. After a few moments, though, he abandoned his peak, kneaded the bedclothes and my feet gently with his claws, and began to purr in a somnolent fashion. I found his presence almost as soothing as Jamie's soft, regular snoring. For the most part, I felt at home, secure in the place I had made for myself in this world, happy to be with Jamie whatever the circumstances. But now and then I saw suddenly and clearly the magnitude of the gulf I had crossed, and the dizzying loss of the world I'd been born to, and felt very much alone. And afraid. Hearing this man's words, his panic and desperation, had brought back to me the memory of all the terror and doubts of my journeys through the stones. I cuddled close to my sleeping husband, warmed and anchored, and heard Ottertooth's words as though they were spoken in my inner ear, a cry of desolation that echoed through the barriers of time and language. Toward the foot of that one page, the tiny Latin writing had grown increasingly hasty, some of the letters no more than dots of ink, the endings of words swallowed in a frantic spider's dance. And then the last lines, done in English, the writer's Latin dissolved in desperation.
Oh God, oh God, where are they?
It was afternoon of the next day before we managed to collect Brianna, Roger and Ian and retire privately to Jamie's study without attracting unwanted attention. The night before, the haze of fatigue following on the heels of Ian's sudden appearance had combined to make almost anything seem reasonable. But going about my chores in the bright light of morning, I found it increasingly difficult to believe that the journal really existed and wasn't merely something I had dreamed. There it was, though, small, but black and solid on Jamie's desk table. He and Ian had spent the morning in his study, immersed in translation. When I joined him, I could tell by the way Jamie's hair was sticking up that he had found the journal's account either deeply absorbing, terribly upsetting, or possibly both.
"I've told them what it is," he said, without preamble, nodding toward Roger and Bree.
The two of them sat close together on stools, looking solemn. Jemmy, having refused to be parted from his mother, was under the table, playing with a string of carved wooden beads. "Have you read the whole thing?" I asked, subsiding into the extra chair. Jamie nodded, with a glance at young Ian, who stood by the window, too restless to sit. His hair was cropped short, but nearly as disordered as Jamie's.
"Aye, we have. I'm no going to read the whole thing aloud, but I thought I'd best start with the bit where he's made up his mind to put it all down from the beginning."
He had marked the spot with the scrap of tanned leather he customarily used as a bookmark. Opening the journal, he found his spot and began to read.
"The name I was given at birth is Robert Springer. I reject this name and all that goes with it because it is the bitter fruit of centuries of murder and injustice, a symbol of theft, slavery and oppression."
Jamie looked up over the edge of the book, remarking,
"You see why I didn't want to read every word. The man's guide tedious about it."
Running a finger across the page, he resumed,
"In the year of our Lord, their Lord, that Christ in whose name they rape and pillage and, well, more of the same, but when he gets down to it, it was the year 1968. So I suppose you'll be familiar with all this murder and pillage he's talking about."
He raised his eyebrows at Bree and Roger. Bree sat up abruptly, clutching Roger's arm. "I know that name," she said, sounding breathless. "Robert Springer. I know it." "You knew him?" I asked, feeling a thrill of something, excitement, dread, or simple curiosity run through me. She shook her head. "No, I didn't know him, but I know the name. I saw it in the newspaper. Did you?" She turned toward Roger, but he shook his head, frowning. "Well, maybe you wouldn't in the UK, but it was a big deal in Boston. Think, Robert Springer was one of the Montauk Five." Jamie pinched the bridge of his nose.
"The Five what?"
"It was just a thing people did to call attention to themselves." Brianna flipped a hand in dismissal. "It's not important. They were AIM activists, or at least they started out that way, only they were even too nuts for AIM, and so..." "Nuts. Why nuts?" Jemmy, picking up the only word of personal interest out of this account, emerged from under the table. "Not that kind of nuts, baby, sorry." Looking around for some object of interest to distract him, Bree slipped off her silver bracelet and gave it to him. Seeing the puzzled looks on the faces of father and cousin, she took a deep breath and started over, trying, with occasional clarifications from Roger and me, to define things and give a short, if confused, account of the sad state of the American Indian in the 20th century.
So this Robert Springer is, or was, an Indian of sorts in your own time.
Jamie tapped his fingers in a brief tattoo on the table, frowning in concentration.
Well, that corresponds with his own account. He and his friends apparently took no little exception to the behaviour of what they called whites. I would suppose those to be Englishmen, or Europeans at least.
Well, yes, except that by 1968, of course, they weren't Europeans any more. They were Americans. Only the Indians were Americans first. And so that's when they started calling themselves Native Americans, and...
Roger patted her knee, stopping her in mid-flow.
Perhaps we can do the history a bit later,
he suggested.
What was it you read about Robert Springer in the papers?
Oh. Taken aback, she furrowed her brow in concentration. He disappeared. They disappeared. The Montauk Five, I mean. They were all wanted by the government for blowing things up or threatening to or something, I forget. And they were arrested. But then they got out on bail and the next thing you know, they'd all disappeared.
Evidently so, young Ian murmured, glancing toward the journal.
It was a big deal in the papers for a week or so, Brianna went on. The other activist types were all accusing the government of having done away with them, so that stuff coming out of the trial wouldn't embarrass the government. And of course the government was denying it. So there was a big search on, and I think I remember reading that they found the body of one of the missing men out in the woods somewhere in New Hampshire or Vermont or someplace. But they couldn't tell how he died, and nobody turned up any trace of the others.
Where are they? I quoted softly, the hair rippling on the back of my neck. My God, where are they?
Jamie nodded soberly.
Aye, then. I think this Springer may well be your man.
He touched the page before him with something like respect.
He and his four companions all renounced any association with the white world, taking new names from their real heritage. Or so he says. That would be the proper thing to do, Ian said softly.
He had a new strange stillness to him, and I was forcibly reminded that he had been a Mohawk for the last 2 years, washed free of his white blood, renamed Wolf's brother, one of the Ganawaga, the guardians of the Western Gate. I thought Jamie was aware of this stillness too, but he kept his eyes on the journal, flipping pages slowly as he summarised their content.
This ends Disc 46. The Fiery Cross, Disc 47.
Robert Springer, or Ottertooth, as he chose henceforth to call himself, had numerous associations in the shadow world of extremist politics, and the deeper shadows of what he called Native American shamanism. I had no notion how much resemblance there was between what he was doing and the original beliefs of the Iroquois, but Ottertooth believed that he was descended from the Mohawk and embraced such remnants of tradition as he could find or invent. It was at a naming ceremony that I first met Raymond. I sat up abruptly hearing that. He'd mentioned Raymond in the beginning, but I'd taken no particular note of the name, then. "Does he describe this Raymond?" I asked urgently. Jamie shook his head.
"Not in terms of appearance, no. He only says that Raymond was a great shaman who could transform himself into birds or animals and who could walk through time," he added delicately.
He glanced at me, one eyebrow raised. "I don't know," I said. I thought so once, but now I don't know. What? Brianna was looking back and forth between us, puzzled. I shook my head, smoothing back my hair. Never mind. Someone I knew in Paris was named Raymond, and I thought, but what in the name of anything would he be doing in America in 1968? I burst out.
Well, you were there, I, Jamie pointed out. But putting that aside for the moment.
He returned to the text, laying it all out in the oddly stilted English of the translation. Intrigued by Raymond, Ottertooth had met with the man repeatedly and brought several of his closest friends to him as well. Gradually the scheme,
A great audacious plan, stunning in conception.
Modest, isn't he?
Roger muttered. Had been conceived. There was a test. Many failed, but I did not. There were five of us who passed the test, who heard the voice of time. Five of us who swore in our blood and by our blood that we would undertake this great venture, to rescue our people from catastrophe, to rewrite their history and redress their wrongs, to...
Roger gave a faint groan.
Oh, God, he said. What did they mean to do? Assassinate Christopher Columbus?
Not quite, I said. He meant to arrive before 1600, he said. What happened then, do you know?
I don't know, Ken, what happened then, Jamie told me, rubbing a hand through his hair. But I ken well enough what he thought he was doing. His plan was to go to the Iroquois League and rouse them against the white settlers. He thought that there were few enough settlers then that the Indians could easily wipe them out if the Iroquois led the way.
Perhaps he was right, Ian said softly. I've heard the old people tell the stories. When the first of the Osoroni came, how they were welcomed, how they brought trade goods. 100 years ago, the Osoroni were few, and the Ganawaga were masters, leaders of the nations. Aye, they could have done it, had they wished to.
Well, but he couldn't possibly have stopped the Europeans, Brianna objected. There were just way too many.
He didn't mean to get the Mohawk to invade Europe, did he?
A broad grin crossed Jamie's face at the thought.
I should have liked to see that, he said. The Mohawk would have given the Sassenach something to think about. But no, alas.
He gave me a sardonic look.
Our friend Robert Springer wasn't quite so ambitious.
What Ottertooth and his companions had had in mind was sufficiently ambitious, though, and perhaps, just perhaps, possible. Their intention wasn't to prevent white settlement altogether. They were, just barely, sane enough to realise the impossibility of that. What they intended was to put the Indians on their guard against the whites, to establish trade on their terms, to deal from a position of power.
Instead of allowing them to settle in great numbers, they might keep the whites bottled up in small towns. Instead of allowing them to build fortifications, demand weapons from the start. Establish trade on their own terms, keep them outnumbered and outgunned, and force the Europeans to teach them the ways of metal.
Prometheus Redux, I said.
And Jamie snorted. Roger shook his head, half admiringly.
It's a crack-brain scheme, he said. But you do have to admire their league nerve. It might just possibly have worked, if he could convince the Iroquois, and if they acted at the right time before the balance of power shifted to the Europeans. It all went wrong, though, didn't it? First he comes to the wrong time, much too late. And then he realises none of his friends have made it with him.
I saw the goosebumps rise suddenly on Brianna's arms and caught the look she sent me, one of sudden understanding. She had abruptly imagined just how it might be to arrive suddenly out of one's own time, alone. I gave her a small smile and put my hand on Jamie's arm. Absent-mindedly, he put his own hand over mine and squeezed it gently.
Aye. He nearly despaired, as he says, when he realised that it had all gone wrong. He thought of going back, but he didn't have a gemstone anymore. And this Raymond had said you must have one for protection.
He did find one eventually, though, I said. Getting up, I reached to the top shelf and brought down the big raw opal, its inner fire flickering through the carved spiral on its surface. That is, I'm assuming there can't have been multiple Indians named Ottertooth associated with Snake Town. Tewak Tignon, an elderly Mohawk woman and leader of the Council of Mothers, had given me the stone when we went to the village of Snake Town to rescue Roger from captivity. She also told me the story of Ottertooth and how he met his death, and I shivered, though it was warm in the room. The big, smooth stone felt warm in my hand, too. I rubbed a thumb gingerly over the spiral.
The snake that eats its tail, he'd said. Aye, he doesn't mention that, though.
Jamie sat back, running both hands through his loosened hair, then rubbing a hand over his face.
The story ends with him deciding that there's no help for it, whatever year it may be. And he had no notion, and whether he was alone or not, he would carry out his plan.
Everyone was silent for a moment, regarding the enormity and the futility of such a plan.
"He can't have thought it would work,"
Roger said, the rasping husk of his voice giving the words a sense of finality. Jamie shook his head, looking down at the book, though his eyes were clearly looking through it, dark blue and remote.
"Nor he did,"
he said softly.
"What he said here at the last,"
his fingers touched the page very gently,
"was that thousands of his people had died for their freedom. Thousands more would die in years to come. He would walk the path they walked for the honour of his blood. And to die fighting was no more than a warrior of the Mohawk should ask."
I heard Ian draw breath behind me in a sigh, and Brianna bent her head so the bright hair hid her face. Roger's own face was turned toward her, grave in profile. But it was none of them I saw. I saw a man with his face painted black for death, walking through a dripping forest at night, holding a torch that burned with cold fire. A yank on my skirt pulled me away from this vision, and I glanced down to find Jemmy standing beside me, pulling on my hand.
"What's that?"
"What?"
"Oh, it's a rock, sweetheart. A pretty rock, see?"
I held out the opal, and he seized it with both hands, plumping down on his bottom to look at it. Brianna wiped a hand under her nose, and Roger cleared his throat with a noise like ripping cloth.
"What I want to know," he said gruffly, gesturing toward the journal, "is why in hell did he write that in Latin?"
"Oh, he says that. He learned Latin in school. Perhaps that was what turned him against Europeans."
Jamie grinned at young Ian, who grimaced.
"And he thought if he wrote in Latin, anyone who happened to see it would think it only a priest's book of prayers and pay it no heed."
"They did think that, the Ganawaga," Ian put in. "Old Tewagtenion kept the book, though. And when I left, she gave me the wee book and said as I must bring it back wi' me and give it to you, Auntie Claire."
"To me?" I felt a sense of hesitation at touching the book, but nonetheless reached out a hand and touched the open pages. The ink, I saw, had begun to run dry toward the end. The letters skipped and stuttered, and some words were no more than indentations on the paper. Had he thrown the empty pen away, I wondered, or kept it, a useless reminder of his vanished future?
"Do you think she knew what was in the book?" I asked.
Ian's face was impassive, but his soft hazel eyes held a hint of trouble.
When he had been a Scot, he hadn't been one to hide his feelings. "I dinna ken," he said. "She kent something, but I couldna say what. She didna tell me, only that I must bring you the book."
He hesitated, glancing from me to Brianna and Roger, then back.
"Is it true," he asked, "what you said, cousin, about what will happen to the Indians?"
She looked up, meeting his eyes squarely, and nodded.
"I'm afraid so," she said softly. "I'm sorry, Ian."
He only nodded, rubbing a knuckle down the bridge of his nose. But I wondered. He hadn't forsaken his own people, I knew, but the Ganawaga were his as well, no matter what had happened to cause him to leave. I was opening my mouth to ask Ian about his wife when I heard Jemmy. He had retired back under the table with his prize and had been talking to it in a genially conversational, if unintelligible, manner for several minutes. His voice had suddenly changed, though, to a tone of alarm.
"Hot," he said. "Mummy, hot."
Brianna was already rising from her stool, a look of concern on her face, when I heard the noise. It was a high-pitched ringing sound, like the weird singing of a crystal goblet when you run a wet finger round and round the rim. Roger sat up straight, looking startled. Brianna bent and snatched Jemmy out from under the table, and as she straightened with him, there was a sudden pow, like a gunshot, and the ringing noise abruptly stopped.
"Holy God," said Jamie,
rather mildly under the circumstances. Splinters of